So we are making our way through the seven churches in chapters 2 and 3 of Revelation, the letters that Jesus had written for those seven churches in what is now modern Turkey. And we're almost finished. So we've got two churches left this week and next week, which takes us beautifully up to the family service. And then I'm undecided, after we come back, if we just have 1 week of recap and just pick up some of the key themes and some of the key issues that God wants to talk to the churches about. So that's, we'll see what happens, but we've got two letters to cover this week and, excuse me, next week. We're looking at the church in Philadelphia. Okay, then, founded about, it should come on, guys, we have a screen there. Folks, do you have my, yes, it's there. Okay, don't worry too much about just this list of information. It just gives us a wee bit of history background, and some of it is of some importance to our talk today. So, founded in 160 BC, between Eumannes, who really had an incredible devotion to his brother Attalus and Attalus. And it was that brotherly love. Philadelphia means brotherly love, and we get that Greek word phile, to love, and phile is brotherly love. And so Philadelphia literally is named as brotherly love, and I think we could probably preach a sermon on that alone. The name of the city reflects the love of these two brothers. It was a relatively small church just in terms of its geographical location and where it was in the province. Like Smyrna, and this is only Smyrna and this church are the only two churches that don't get any criticism. They really just get praise and reassurance. And we'll look at that reassurance later on. They're given some, not warnings, but they're given some advice how to protect themselves. And I think that's helpful for us all. The city itself was absolutely devastated by an earthquake in AD 17. So when Jesus was born, it went through a devastating, and yet Rome just pummeled massive amount of money in it to rebuild it again. But that left, there were certain parts of it that were remained standing, particularly those that were really founded on strong pillars, and that's going to become a theme this morning. And so the pillars, most of the pillars in sort of Corinthian style were actually earthquake tolerant, and they were built to last because obviously that part of the world is exposed to earthquakes, and so they built many of the big buildings to be to be able to cope with an earthquake. I think that's, I read this, I thought this was funny. It's God was Dionysus, the god of wine. Okay. The god of, I didn't know there was a god of wine. Now, we obviously follow the Judeo-Christian God, okay? But we believe there's only one God. But if there was to be another God, I think a lot of people wouldn't mind if it was a God of wine, okay? A God of wine. Anyway, so their God was the God of wine. Here we are. This is where Philadelphia are. So it's fairly inland now as we're moving away from the coast. Apart from Laodicea, it was the most furthermost eastern town, and it was pretty high up, which just made access that wee bit more limited. And that's why it would be suggested it would be one of the smaller cities and one of the smaller churches as a result of that. We'll come back to this. The Bible in our letter today talks about being pillars. Okay, then. By the 4th century, they built an incredible church in Philadelphia. And they built it on six massive pillars, the biggest pillars I've ever seen in my life. And you'll get four of those pillars are still standing, but this will give you size of those pillars. And so even God says, you know, I will build you on these pillars, that the church went ahead just 400 years later and built this incredible edifice. And the pillars are still standing today. And it's that idea of foundation and pillars that we're going to concentrate on today. Also, within many Corinthian pillars, and particularly in Turkey, people's names, you know, of famous people in the city, their names would be written in the architect and people involved in the building and people of notable history. Their names would be inscribed into the pillars. And this is a photograph of one such pillar whose names were written on the pillar. And again, just an important little connection there for us to come back to later on in our talk. So let's read our letter together. Write to the church in Philadelphia. Write to the angel in the church in Philadelphia. The Holy One, the true one, the one who has the key of David, who opens and no one will close, who closes and no one says, and no one opens. I know your works because you have limited strength. You have kept my word. You have not denied my name. Look, I have placed before you an open door that no one is able to close. So take note. I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who claim to be Jews and are not, but are lying, note this, that I will make them come and bow down at your feet. And they will know that I have loved you. There's that wonderful theme that Tony brought out. See, Tony does listen and he's a week ahead of me. They will know that I have loved you. Because you have kept my command to endure, I will also keep you from the hour of testing that is going to come over the whole world to test those who live on the earth. I am coming quickly. Hold on to what you have so that no one takes your crown. The victor, I will make him a pillar in the sanctuary of my God, and he will never go out again. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and my new name. Anyone who has an ear should listen to what the Spirit is saying to the churches. Let's move on, just as an extra slide there. So, the key, we'll just go through some of those key points that we've mentioned today, and we'll triple in and see what is God saying to us in our walk with God. What words of encouragement does he have for us as a church and as individuals? The Holy One, the true one. All of these letters start off with these wonderful two key words that Tony's mentioned, I know. And we'll come back to the I know. But he also, all of the letters start off describing some quality of Jesus, some eternal quality that they can focus on and realize his supremacy and his sovereignty and his omnipotence and omniscience. And here he describes himself as the Holy One, the true one, the one who has the keys of David. Now remember, there's going to come a comparison later on of people who were calling themselves Jews, but they were not. We'll get to that, but the fact is that Jesus is saying that whatever they call themselves, you can depend on me because I am holy and I am true and I am faithful. And when I open a door, it will be opened. And when I close a door, it will be closed. And I'm reminded of the words of Isaiah in 22. And we need to go back a little bit into the history of that. But the king at that time had given the doorkeeper the keys of the temple, who had control who came in and who came out of the temple. And we read in Isaiah 22, I will place the key of the house of David on his shoulder. And what he opens, no one can close. And what he closes, no one can open. So very similar words that came down, that were handed down from the time of David and the kings. And just to talk about who was allowed into the presence of God and who would be kept out because of their lifestyle. Let's not forget, and I've put this at the bottom of your screen, but let's not forget, Christ alone has the authority to admit or to exclude from his kingdom. I know God's grace. I know why Jesus died. I know that Jesus died for the whole world. But it's Christ who has the sovereignty over eternity. And people don't get to decide to go to heaven because they were good. They don't get to heaven because they come from a Christian family. There's a new set of guidelines that was introduced when Jesus came. And I think that's going to be for another story. So it was King Hezekiah who had given Eliakim the keys to the temple. He had said, you're in charge of who enters and you can close and you can open at your discretion. And Jesus is saying, I've got the keys. I've got the keys of those who come into the kingdom. And for us to consider, I know your works. I know your works. It's difficult because we know that works doesn't save us. We know that we come from very much of that the justified shall live by faith alone. And it's faith in Jesus Christ that is going to save us. But the Bible never on any occasion excludes the power and the importance and the relevance of serving him, of being faithful to him, of being committed to his call and to his kingdom and to living righteously and right. And so in our balancing of theology that he's a God of grace, but he's also a God of discipline and discipleship. And we've been saved not by good works, but to do good works. And so we have this theological tension running through the Bible and running through our lives at all times. But God places importance on serving him. And we must, as a church, never forget that. But I love this next phrase. I know your works, but you have limited strength. So it's... you have limited strength. Life can be exhausting, okay? You just feel sometimes that your energy levels, I know I'm not as young as some of you are today, but sometimes it just feels that the energy gets sapped out of you because of the demands of life and family and what's happening in the world and post-COVID, and we're trying to spin lots of plates. We know that we have limited energy. We have limited ability. We cannot do everything. And this is one of those little phrases that God says he gets it. He understands that we don't have the same resources that he has because he is infinite and he is God. But we are mortal and we are human. And we have limited strength. And I'm just so reassured of this. Before God even goes fully into his commendation of this church, he realizes that they have their struggles. And they have their limitations. They're at the point where they just simply have no more energy. And they might even be questioning whether they have the momentum to go another day or another week or another year. How can they sustain this? How can they sustain the journey? Because they're running out of energy. They're running out of a sense of having the strength to do it. Contrast that with the church in Smyrna, who were strong in their own sight. They were strong in their own strength. The Philadelphian church, on the other hand, had little strength. And we might look at that, or people in the world might look at those two churches and pity the Philadelphians. But actually, God is commending them. God is saying, because you're weak in your own strength, then you're going to absolutely have to depend on me. Three times I asked God to take away this thorn, but three times he says, my strength will be made perfect in your weakness. And God celebrates human weakness. He doesn't rejoice in it, but he celebrates it because it brings dependability. It brings a need to come before him and to say that I cannot do this on my own strength. I need your help. God's special characteristics is that he has concern for the broken, for the empty, for the lost. God doesn't help those who can help themselves. He helps those who cannot help themselves. The broken, the humble. And on the other hand, the proud and the self-sufficient feel that they don't need God. I know your works, because you have lived and see strength. Winston Churchill, speaking to a boys' school at the time, says, never give in. Never, 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 never give in. In nothing great or small, large or petty, never give in except to your convictions of honour and good sense. Never yield to force. Never yield to the apparently overwhelming might of the enemy. If we can take those words of a political leader, then Jesus is coming along and he's reinforcing that for us. And he's telling us to just to endure, but he's not leaving us alone. He's not leaving us helpless, because he knows we're at the end of our own physical capability. I know. And I have placed before you an open door that no one will be able to shut. It would appear that many of the Jewish people had banned the Christians from entering the synagogue. We find similar stories that in the book of John, where people were scared to associate themselves with Jesus, the parents of the blind man, because they feared that they would be put out of the synagogue. And many of these Jewish people, Jewish believers, had become Christians and they had been put out of the synagogue. But Jesus is saying, even though that may have happened to you, doors may have closed on your life, but I am the one who opens doors. I am the one who makes things happen. And when I open a door, you can trust me, because we've already read it. You can put your hope in this statement that when I open a door, it will remain open. Paul often talked about open doors in the book of Acts, that God opened doors for him to preach the gospel and to minister. And God was opening the door of this church. God was saying, I've made a way for you to get through. And there's going to come a great time of hardship, but I'm going to give you guys relief from that's coming upon the whole world. Philadelphia, you can see how, you remember on the map how close it was one of the furthermost cities. But what it was is it was a passageway. The reason it was there, it was a passageway through to the east. It was seen as a door to the east, from the western city trade centers. In order to move into inland, Philadelphia was seen as a gateway. And God is saying, I am that gate. I am the gate of life. Those who are from the synagogue of Satan, who claim to be Jews and who are not. Jewish people, many of them passionately believe in the providence of God, the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob, who followed the kings and the prophets, who hold dear the law of Moses to their hearts. But Paul writes and tells us, and he says, now, let's look a little bit of who are really Jews and who are not Jews. For a person is not a Jew who is one just outwardly. True circumcision is not something that's visible in the flesh. On the contrary, a Jew is only a Jew when he is a Jew inwardly. It's the heart. And Paul takes that same analogy, of course, and applies it to the body of Christ, to the church. That it's a heart issue. And these so-called Jews were attacking the Christians. And it wasn't just because they were attacking Christians. Paul was basically saying, I'm doubting their Jewish connection. Because really, it was out of the heart that established their Jewishness. It was an inner thing that made that happen. But whatever come what may, whoever may persecute us, whoever may give us a hard time, whoever may try and close the door on our lives, God says some to us, one day they will know that you love me. And it's just almost this little line is sneaked in at the end of this word of reassurance from their persecutors. One day they will come to acknowledge my love towards you. And I'm just challenged by that, by to make sure that his love, his agape love, his eternal love. And remember that this city, this is a city of love, the city of brotherly love, that these people will one day realize my eternal love that is upon your lives. They will come to know. And Isaiah, we go back to Isaiah again, and so much of this letter has got those little inferences in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 60, the children of your oppressors will come and they will bow before you. And all who despise you will bow down at your feet, and they will call the city of the Lord, the Zion, the Holy One of Israel. A recognition. Paul writes and he says that every knee will bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. But I will keep you because of your endurance, because of your faithfulness in me, I will keep you from the hour of testing. And I will come and I will spare you of that. And this little phrase here, I will come. And the other two times that he mentions about coming to visit the churches, it was to discipline them. It was to filter out the sheep from the goats. But not in this case. And this says, when I come to you guys, I'm coming to protect you. I'm coming to look after you. I'm coming to put a ring of protection around your church. And I will be coming back again. And you can be assured that I am in absolute and complete and total control. And world events are not going to decide your future. Because I'm coming to you and I'm going to be with you. When I come to you, I will establish you as pillars in the city. I will write your names on the pillars. And I will give you a crown of life. Those who live on the earth, the persecutors, those who don't know Jesus. It's interesting, I only came across this little phrase through the week in one of my commentaries now. I couldn't help read it and then not dig deeper. But the actual Hebrew, the actual Greek says, not those who live in the earth, but earth dwellers. Like some bit of science fiction, the earth dwellers. And I began to look at this phrase, and it's actually quite common. It just never comes out in our English, the earth dwellers. And God is saying, you know, what distinguishes us from the earth dwellers is that we are kingdom people, that we are heaven dwellers, that we are people of eternity. And our future is not on the earth. Our future is in glory. And so it's this wonderful phrase that once you begin to take, reword, and you know, this single word, earth dwellers, you realize it's where some people belong and where some people are destined for. And you will be, and I will make him a pillar in my sanctuary. All temples, if you look at the archaeology in Turkey just now, most of the buildings that are still standing are temples. Most of the buildings that are still standing are temples. And the reason for that those temples are still standing is they were built to cope with earthquake damage. Their foundations, and I was just reading on this, their foundations were laid in charcoal, covered with fleece, in order to almost make the structures float. Like soil on a raft, each block was joined together with metal clamps in order to have strength and unity as a complete unit. And many of these temples were some of the most secure structures in the whole of the kingdom. And Jesus is saying, I'm going to make you into a pillar. This church is going to become a pillar, and I'm going to inscribe your name on the pillar. These pillars were earthquake strong. They could cope with the earthquakes. Now, Philadelphia was quite unusual just because of where it was located and because of that incredible earthquake in AD 17. that very often what would happen is that people would flee the city whenever there was tremors. And there was tremors for about 30 years after the AD 17 earthquake. Another place they would run to is the temples, because the temples were so well built. They ran into the temple in order to have protection. And I will give you a new name. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of my city, the New Jerusalem. I will give you a new name. This is really close to home for the Philadelphians, who in the last 40 years of the history, their name had been changed twice. Okay, then. They were called Neo-Caesarea because it was a new city that had been built after AD 17. The city was given a new name. It was later changed to Flavia, and eventually it became Philadelphia. So when God says, I will give you a new name, these inhabitants of these cities, they got the importance of a new name. They got the importance of their name being written on the temples. They got the importance of being established and on the foundation of Jesus Christ, the ultimate temple, and we are the pillars. So as we come to a close, as we approach this afternoon, what is our application for this particular church? We need to make sure that we stay and we endure. We need to make sure that we widen our knowledge of God's truth, God's righteousness, and God's holiness. We need to continue to be a witness, because he will open the doors for us. And we need to watch and pray and remain faithful to him.